Musings Podcast with Fairbairn and Russell. Hello and welcome to the Market Musings Podcast, where today we're joined by our guest from Mode Global Holdings PLC, ticker on the London Stock Exchange as Mode, M-O-D-E. Jonathan Rowland, the Executive Chairman, is with us. Hi, Jonathan. How are you?
I'm very well, Mark. How are you?
Very good. Thank you, Jonathan. It's good to be having you on the podcast. I know we did an interview, or Stockbox did an interview with you not so long ago, where we learned a little bit about what the business is all about. But it's very good to have you on the Musings podcast, where we'll hopefully learn a little bit more about you, your past, and sort of what motivates you and your achievements. So, of course, we're joined by Kenny from Scotland. How are you, Kenny?
Yep, all good. Great to have you on, Jonathan. Where is it you're based yourself?
I'm currently in Guernsey, but I'm generally in the UK, in London. So the businesses I'm involved in are in and around London, but that doesn't really matter these days when we're all remote.
Yeah. So, one benefit of COVID, I suppose, everybody's learned how to use Zoom. The world just continues, so it does.
It just became the norm now. I'm used to seeing my team on the screen every day. I haven't seen them in person for a year. It's a new norm.
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it, man? What is the lockdown situation like in the Channel Islands then?
They were doing really well. And last year we locked down in conjunction with the UK, but they came out of lockdown in May and they came out completely. So they were down to sort of two or three cases in Guernsey, and you were able to go to the restaurants, the shops. There was no masks, there were no social distancing, there was no restrictions, and we were happily in our own little bubble. And then mid-January, somebody got out and infected somebody, and we suddenly had a spike to about 300-400 people. So they locked down again very heavily, and in Guernsey they went. On the flip side, you know, they went very, they were very strict in terms of the lockdown, and they were equally very lax, not lax, but everyone was allowed to do anything. So it was completely different ends of the spectrum. You know, we've been in lockdown now for best part of 8 weeks, but we are coming out on Monday totally again. So on Monday, you will be able to go to the restaurants, the shops, and there'll be no restrictions again. So they're down to one case again. So got control of it very quickly and very well.
Mm-hmm. Oh well, that's good news, but it is quite bizarre, as you say. It's either end of the spectrum, you know. It's strange, but every country is different, I suppose, or every region's different. So there we go. But all right, yeah. No, as I was saying, it's great to have you on, Jonathan. And what we like to do in the podcast is find out about yourself. You know, people invest in people. You know, you can have the best company in the world, but if you don't have the right people, you know, running the projects within the company, then it doesn't work. So really it's an opportunity for you to tell us a bit about yourself. And as Mark said earlier on, you know, we can go back as far as you want, you know, where you were born and what it was like growing up and education, early career, university, etc. It's really, the floor is yours, maybe for the next 10 minutes to give us a bit of background on yourself.
Sure. The first question I got to ask you guys is, I've been watching these or listening to these Joe Rogan podcasts. I don't know if you listen to Joe Rogan.
Mm-hmm.
And I listened to a couple of funny ones today, but they were smoking cigars and drinking whiskey. I was wondering if that's something we would be doing on this podcast.
You can if you want. I'm not, but it is Friday.
Yeah. And it's sunny. It's sunny in Scotland, at least.
Yeah.
Usually I do have a beer in my hand.
Yes, usually you do.
I'm on a bit of a weight loss journey at the moment, so I'm trying to behave myself. So unfortunately, it's a cup of coffee only. But generally, I do have a beer in my hand.
So generally, yes, it's allowed.
So feel free.
Feel free, yeah.
Thanks. My background is, I left school at 16, so I wasn't particularly academic, as you can tell from that. And I worked in a few jobs when I was young, and generally progressed through to working in my family office when I was about 19, 20. And that just in the early days was basically, you know, learning the ropes of the family business, which was, it was real estate focused. It was deal orientated. We were doing many different things in many different sectors. And in 1999, I established a business called Jellyworks. And if you're old enough to remember that, it was a internet incubator back in the late 90s when the internet was coming of age. It's quite strange to think it's only 20, 25 years since the commercial mainstream internet was mainstream. But I set up an internet incubator. I listed it on the AIM market in London. There was a lot of buzz around it. I was only 24 years old, so I was very young. People looked at it and said, how can this guy know what he's doing? I surrounded myself with some good people. And we floated that in 99, and it was well received in terms of the stock market. I think we floated at 10p a share, and on day two, it was £2. So it was in those crazy days of the boom. And we sold that business the following June. So it was listed in December 99, and we sold it in 2000 June, just as things were starting to burst a little bit. And we sold it to a company called Shore Capital. And Shore Capital is a stockbroker, an investment bank in the UK, which you've probably heard of. We formed the pillars to their listing. So Jellyworks left Shore Capital with basically a large amount of cash of investments that we had sold and made money on. And they created their listed vehicle out of reversing into Jellyworks, and Shore Capital is still listed now today. After that, I was involved in many different areas of investment and financing. Just giving you a sort of potted history, did a lot of mining deals. We owned gold mines and diamond mines and copper mines and all sorts of land packages where mining was possible, getting mining permits. We had a company called Latitude Resources, which was listed on AIM too. We took over another company, I can't remember the name of it, and we renamed it Latitude Resources. And we had a big copper interest in Chile, and I ran that business, and I ran other investments that we made in gold mining in Nevada, Canada, South Africa. So we had a sort of 2004 to 2008, we did a lot of mining transactions. We also established a mining fund with Investec Bank, joint venture between their balance sheet and our balance sheet. And we created a fund to invest in mining ventures. And that was wound up in about 2009. And many different, you know, just deals. We were very much a deal-driven family. We weren't really focused on any one particular sector, but we just did deals. We were opportunistic. We went against the flow. We were contrarian, we were cautious, we always held a very large portion of our wealth in cash. And then most relevant to the conversation that we're going to have was in 2009, I led a team on behalf of my family office to restructure what was then Kaupthing Bank Luxembourg. And Kaupthing Bank was the largest Icelandic bank at the time. And the Luxembourg subsidiary was a pretty large bank, and it was the access to the ECB, the European Central Bank, for Kaupthing to get a form of funding from the ECB. So they had to set up a subsidiary in Luxembourg to do so. When the credit crisis came in 2008, all the Icelandic banks collapsed, as you remember.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Kaupthing was the largest. And the Luxembourg Bank, which was a separate entity, also collapsed. And we were approached by a lawyer who said, would you be interested in restructuring a bank? At first, we said no. But as we looked at it more closely, we said, okay, this could be interesting. And within 6 to 8 months, we restructured that bank in cooperation with the Central Bank of Luxembourg, the government of Luxembourg, the Central Bank and government of Iceland, the government of Belgium, and the government of the UK. It was a unprecedented restructuring where we created good and bad bank. So you've heard of the saying good and bad bank, probably, have you? From the crisis days.
Yeah.
We coined that phrase. So Kaupthing Law became of the restructuring of the bank that we created. And that was the first time under banking law in Europe where a bank had been split good and bad. And that meant that a number of the assets on the good side were put into a new entity and issued a new banking license, which we took on. And what they referred to as the bad assets, which weren't necessarily bad, were put into a securitization vehicle on behalf of the creditors who had been creditors to the bank when it collapsed. So no one knew how to do that. Every law firm in Luxembourg was involved, all these stakeholders, and us taking the risk as a family investment office. We restructured and relaunched the bank with a new banking license, approximately 1.5 billion euros of assets, which were called good. And the bad side was about a similar size. And we managed that as the good bank, which was renamed Bank Haviland. We managed that on behalf of the creditors as the agent to wind down the bad side. That bank still exists today. We are 100% owner of it. It is a global private bank. We've made a few acquisitions. The learning curve of the collapse and the crisis and the restructuring was something that I was very close to. I became CEO of the bank. And there's lots of stories which are fun around this, but I won't go into them now, but maybe on another occasion we can talk a bit about some of the interesting situations that went on during the banking crisis and people not knowing what to do, which way to look, which way to run. But I had a front seat view of what was going on. So that led up to about 2013 for me. So 2009, 2013, I was operating the bank as the CEO. And then, unfortunately, I had a very bad brain hemorrhage in 2013. Mm-hmm. And this is all documented in a TED talk that I did in 2014. And I was out of action for a couple of years, and I recovered. It was all very nasty, but somewhat of a miracle that I survived. And I came out with a different sort of view on life, and I looked at what I wanted to do next. And I decided that because of the banking experience I'd had during the crisis with Kaupthing and Bank Haviland, that I'd like to try and form a bank in the UK. So I formed a company, and I started a bank in the UK called Redwood Bank. That was licensed by the Prudential Regulatory Authority, or the Bank of England, in 2017. And that is now a profitable business bank for SME lending, very niche, very well known, respected. We are probably the fastest challenger bank to go from application and incorporation to profitability. And probably done it with the least capital and startup costs. And I and members of my family control that. But we have external shareholders, so we have a very interesting public-private partnership there. We have Warrington Borough Council as a minority shareholder with us, and that partnership's been very good. We've done a lot of lending to the northwest Manchester, Warrington area, which has really brought a added value to Warrington, taking a stake in the business when we incorporated it and got the license in 2017. So a lot of banking expertise the last 10, 12 years. But my passion's always been technology. And I'm not a technologist, but I'm a technology fan. And I always had the interest to create a very modern financial services business. And out of the Redwood experience, I decided that I didn't want to spend all my time on that because I wasn't CEO, I wasn't chairman, I was a director and a founder. And I formed Mode, And Mode was formed really 2017-ish. And it went through a few iterations of what it was doing. But that is what the company that is listed, that's when it started. So the plan for that came around about 2017. So that's sort of a very high level potted history of my life, more from the business side of things. I'm an entrepreneur. I've been involved in many sectors geographically, with varying degrees of success and failure. You can only learn from failure as well as success. And with the team that I have at Mode now and the things we're doing there, I think I've found sort of my calling. And I spend most of my time on Mode now. So before I go into Mode, I'll pause there. And if you guys have got any questions or comments, maybe I can mm-hmm. answer that.
Yeah, a couple of points, actually, Jonathan. I mean, fascinating story. I mean, I had absolutely no idea, really, of your background. And it's one of the reasons we do these podcasts, because, it gives you an insight into the person that's running the company, and it's fascinating. One of the things I was going to ask was, you say it's a family business. Has it been going long? Is it a few generations, or is it something your dad created, or is it further back than that?
No, the wealth of the family was created by my father initially, mm-hmm. And then it's progressed onto his children. So it's not a particularly structured family office with a name. We're just a family that invests the wealth that's been built up over a long time. But it's only one, it's only my father's generation that has created that wealth.
Yeah, and
no further back than that.
Yeah, and obviously you got the bug from your father. So no, it's an interesting story, and it's bizarre that you touched upon Challenger Banks as well, because myself and Mark were just having a chat about Challenger Banks before we come on the call. And then when you said they're talking about good banks and bad banks, I definitely think you can categorize some of the challenger banks into good and bad, because I've had some horrific experiences with some of the challenger banks. I won't name them, but there certainly seems to be some decent ones, and there's some that are just abysmal. So there is.
I agree with that. I mean, our bank is, Redwood Bank is not a very large bank. So we're not in the category of the Monzos and the Starlings. Our capital is plus or minus 50 million. And we've been very careful about how we've built that up. We weren't in a rush to grow. We took it very carefully. And we turned a profit within 3 years, which Metro's never turned a profit. Monzo, Starling never turned, well, Starling say they have just now. I won't name names either, but the business model for a lot of these banks doesn't make any sense. And a lot of them seem to be marketing companies with bank licenses. And I think that will all come to a head. So I think that these banks will be forced to merge or to scale back or scale down or change their business model, because The whole point of creating the challenge for the larger banks wasn't to bring in 100 new entrants. It was to bring in a number of new entrants to challenge, and no one's really challenged. And I don't think anyone was ever going to challenge, because the four or five incumbent banks are too big.
Yeah.
Mm. But, I think, before Metro Bank, the last banking license that was issued was something like 100 years. So this is a new sector, really, and it's something that was of interest to me specifically, but it wasn't the most interesting. The things I'm doing at Mode were interesting.
But I wonder if I can just touch on a point you said there about challenger banks never really being that sort of challenging. I use challenger banks as well as mainstream banks, and certainly the process of certainly opening account is extremely straightforward. And I know Kenny has had issues with a particular challenger bank in particular. At the moment, I haven't, and I do like how easy it was to set up and how easy it is to use. My concern, if I have a concern with them, would be that effectively my only interface is an app. There's no history there of having a well-known brand, for example, or a branch you can go into and, you know, demand your money if you need to. But do you not think then that these challenger banks really have changed very much then? Or, I mean, because I was of the opinion that they'd be sort of more widely adopted, particularly by young people who don't want to go through hassle, really, and paperwork.
I mean, listen, I use Monzo, Starling, Revolut. I love all three of them.
Mm.
They are absolutely the easiest way to transfer money, pay for things. But am I going to keep 10, 20 grand there? No, I'm not. But I'm going to keep £500 and I'm going to use it because it's very easy and I love it. The interfaces are fun. They're good. They're easy to use. But beyond that, you know, I think the average balance at some of these challenger banks, and don't hold me to this, but the average customer balance is £200 or £300.
Mm.
Yeah, I think the issue I had, Jonathan, was I was starting to transfer over and above £10,000, and that was started all my issues. And
well, there's so many issues regarding money laundering these days that they have all these restrictions and limits now, and if you start getting to the 10,000 plus mark, you know, there's a lot of questions that come, and the mechanics of answering those questions and getting the right process in place is quite difficult. So I think all these banks are great for small amounts of money at the moment. But when it comes to, you know, buying a house or paying a deposit or buying a car, things get a bit more tricky. But I love it for small stuff, you know, sending money to my kids or to my friends or whatever I need to do. Starling, I probably like the most. I think Monzo works very well. I've got a Metro Bank account. That was more for fun to see what it was all about. But I think, you know, these people have grabbed a lot of customers. But those customers, these banks are their second or third bank accounts. Their first bank accounts are still Barclays, HSBC, NatWest. And it's a long way to see where that's going to change, I believe. I don't think it's going to change overnight. It hasn't. So with Redwood, we just do business. So we just do business deposits and business lending. There's no retail element to it.
Okay. Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah, I was just going to say just briefly, I'm equally as impressed with your background there, as Kenny alluded to earlier. Yeah, I wasn't aware of that background. That's fantastic. You've got tech, you've got mining, and then, of course, banking. Which is great, mining being a particular interest of me and Kenny's for sure. Just quickly, I wonder what was Jellyworks? What actually was that? I Googled it and I found a Guardian article about you actually. But what was the idea behind it and where did it sort of end up?
The idea behind it was to create a vehicle to invest in internet companies. At the time, there were a lot of people doing similar things. So I said, why not me? I was 24, I was interested in that. So I raised, I think, £10 million in 99 on AIM. And we made a number of investments, probably none that you would have ever heard of. Maybe you have. We invested in something called Beans.com, which was quite well known then.
Okay.
Sportal, something called Amp Factory. We invested in a German bank called BMR, which was our best investment. And that really created the biggest gain for us, which Shore Capital utilizes his sort of backbone for his listing.
Okay.
My plan was to be around for a long time, but we were only listed for 7 months.
Yeah.
And then Shore Capital bought it and we moved on.
Okay. Okay.
So the buzz around the internet in the 90s and late 90s, and we were involved in all sorts of stuff in the mid 90s as well. So you've probably heard of a company called Autonomy. We were the founder investors in that with a couple of people in 1993 or 4. We were one of the biggest shareholders of Demon Internet, which Scottish Telecom bought.
Okay.
We had a lot of interest in the internet and technology in those days. And I was a young guy and I was very interested in it and I was part of the process, but I wasn't pulling the trigger. But it reminds me now with the way we have a revolution for financial services in terms of open banking, Bitcoin, all these new challenger banks. It reminds me of a similar opportunity that I saw in the 90s with the internet.
Yeah, okay. I was going to ask you, so you saw that there was a lot of interest in the internet and those kind of things back then. Where's the interest now then? You reckon it is with open finance, open banking?
I think anything where you can get more control of your finances, of your data, of your life, is very interesting. And that's the way it's all going. People don't want to pay for things much anymore. People don't want to give out their details as much as they did. People understood what it means. Data became very important for everyone because that's what we are, just a, you know, a world of data now. And I think the opportunity to be able to manage your finances or investments or savings or mortgages and the way in which you can do is just fascinating to me. And it always has been. I've always been interested in finance. Although I've done mining, I've been in every sector. I've literally been in every sector.
Yeah, Jonathan. There was an interesting statement, and it kind of ties in what you're saying there. Somebody tweeted out, "If you are born today, you will never set foot in a bricks and mortar bank in your life." And I kind of read that and kind of laughed, and then I thought about it and went, "Actually, they're 100% right." I mean, I can't remember the last time I was in the bank, probably once in the last year, maybe. Yeah. And that was only because I had an issue. You know what I mean? So it's...
Yeah. It's, I said, Kenny, I said in 2007, I get quoted this several times a week now. I said in 2007 publicly, I did not believe that banks would have branches by 2020. And that was obviously the way things were going. There's no need to go to a branch unless you're maybe an older person who's comfortable going to a branch. There's no need to go there. So it's painful generally, and you know I do see the possibility of banks having marketing suites on the high street where you can go in and have a coffee and chat about whatever you want. But I don't see branches continuing much longer.
No. Yeah. Definitely not. Oh, well, that leads us nicely on to Mode then. Again, probably the floor is yours, Jonathan, just to give us a nice sort of high-level overview of the company and, you know, how it started and where it is today. And then we can, myself and Mark, can maybe pick your brains because there'll no doubt be a few questions.
Yeah. So the interest came from looking at the financial sector and thinking, what does the future look like? And the future was very much, and I'm talking maybe 5 years ago, 6 years ago, the future was very much things like Revolut, Starling, Monzo, Metro to a lesser extent, Coinbase, some of these companies you're hearing about now, eToro. What does that mean to everyone for the future? And it meant that everything would be delivered through your device, mainly your phone or your laptop or whatever, but primarily your phone. We all manage our stuff, our daily chores, jobs, whatever we've got to do, we manage most of it through our phone. So I looked at it and said, you know, where do I want to be on the spectrum here? Do I want to follow Monzo and Revolut down the path of creating a current account and trying to attract millions of customers? Not really, because the current account is inherently loss-making for anyone. And the cost to put marketing dollars to work and get as many customers as possible is a big number, whoever you are. Mm-hmm. But I thought to myself, I don't want to create a challenger bank like Monzo or Revolut. But I was interested in Bitcoin. I was interested in what Alipay and WeChat Pay were doing in China, using application to do everything and using QR codes and using data to analyze what people may want and trying to get things margins down using data and behavior of people, etc. So the first building block for Mode when it wasn't called Mode, it was called R8 before, was we formed a partnership with WeChat Pay and Alipay, and we became what's called a merchant acquirer for them in the UK. So we got regulated by the FCA. And we were going to merchants in the UK and saying, there's a lot of Chinese overseas travelers. They come here. They can use a credit card, but it's very expensive for them. Cash is very expensive and they can't get cash out of China easily. They do want to use their Alipay and WeChat Pay application, their QR code-based apps. And some of the big merchants started to deploy these point-of-sale systems into their point-of-sale. And we became one of the partners of those two big Chinese companies to start implementing and deploying point-of-sale technology, where we were the tech middleman and we handled the money and settled the money, so that somebody like merchants could basically allow Chinese overseas travelers online or physically to go into stores in the UK, buy items, handbag, whatever, and pay using their QR code on their WeChat or Alipay app. So it'd be like being at home for them in China. Yeah. That's how it started. We then progressed to me wanting to be into the Bitcoin revolution, whatever you want to call it. And we decided the best way to get into what we saw as challenger banking, but not banking because we're not a bank. We saw financial services opportunity as, yes, let's have an application, a digital wallet. But instead of going straight to a current account with sterling or euros or dollars or whatever, let's create a Bitcoin digital wallet. And let's add the other pieces of the pie, being currencies, afterwards. So the app was built with crypto as the focus rather than fiat banking as the focus. So we went the other way around to the other guys and we created the Mode app, which if you've looked at the website or you've had a look around what we're doing, is a very easy way to transfer funds from your bank account to us using faster payments, on board using state-of-the-art brand new technology for KYC, know your customer.
Yep.
And being verified, and your money arriving, if you're verified for KYC and onboarding into the app, your money arriving in less than 2 minutes, usually instantaneously, but certainly less than 2 minutes. And you are able to, in a very easy, simple way, buy Bitcoin. You can also sell Bitcoin if you've bought it, and you can also transfer it in or transfer it out. And you can also hold sterling and euros in the account too. All of your onboarding process takes less than 5 minutes. So you can download our app, transfer money in, go through the KYC, know your client onboarding situation, buy Bitcoin in under 5 minutes, unless there's any issues with the know your client where you may be asked for more documentation. But generally, the normal person coming on can do all of this within 5 minutes, and it's very easy to understand. On top of that, we are the cheapest, if not the cheapest, on the market in terms of a 0.99% trading fee when you buy or sell Bitcoin. And that application was delivered in back end of summer last year. And we didn't start marketing it till really January properly. But we have attracted very big numbers with no marketing dollars. And we do update on a monthly basis the numbers, but I'm not allowed to say where we are at the moment. But it's far exceeded our expectations. So the wallet's created. We have the WeChat and Alipay historic business, legacy business, which is sort of separate at the moment. And we are now deploying our own payments business called Mode for Business. And Mode for Business, which will be launched in Q2 this year, will enable merchants. Again, these can be merchants that we've been dealing with, by the way, on Alipay and WeChat Pay, but many other merchants, and we've signed a number of heads of terms. It will allow the merchant to use our new payment system that bypasses the credit card rails. It bypasses payment rails other than QR code technology, where the consumer can pay direct from their bank account or their Mode account, their Mode wallet, direct to the merchant for goods, online, offline, wherever. And we're looking at things like giving people cashback rewards, but in Bitcoin. So it's a very novel system. And we've now got an end-to-end solution that goes from the consumer to the merchant. Mm-hmm. And this is the beginning of building an ecosystem where everything that's done in that digital wallet, that Mode app wallet, will give us the ability to create this ecosystem to do everything you want financially as we add our products and as we maybe partner with people for further products that we don't see as priority for us. And it's very much the model of Alipay. If you've seen Alipay, you know, full control of your finances from one application rather than 10. And we're starting with the digital wallet, the payment system, some very interesting, clever ways of rewarding customers and merchants. And the, you know, the future looks very exciting for us. In terms of the, just to touch on something we discussed earlier, in terms of the wallet and customer balances, I think we said that Monzo and Starling, those guys, had an average customer balance of £200-£300. Our average customer balance is 2,000 or 3,000. It's literally 10 times. And we believe that is because we are seen as a very, very easy to use app. You know, we're sort of seen as the easiest to use app to buy and sell Bitcoin. Revolut and all these guys have different issues. You know, you don't own your crypto or you can't transfer it out. We offer the whole package, and we're fast becoming the preferred wallet on the market. But we believe that people are interested to put a larger amount of money because they see it as more of a investment into Bitcoin. But what it means is we have a far larger customer balance to then pitch to from the payment side, where the merchants are going to be offering all sorts of deals from that side. So a much larger balance as a captured market than someone like Monzo or Starling or Revolut or whoever. So far, we listed in October, which I think we talked about last time. Our expectations, or my expectations, have been far exceeded so far in terms of take up, interest, and the partners who have come to us on the merchant side, not us going to them. They've come to us because they've seen our podcasts or they've seen our presentations. Are, you know, in some cases, FTSE 100 companies. And this just proves to us that what we are doing, and we believe we have first mover advantage with the package we have, we're in the right place at the right time for sure. And it's very exciting. So
yeah,
I pause there because I've been going on a bit.
Yeah, you actually took the words out of my mouth there, Jonathan, because I was just about to say first mover advantage. I mean, there's no competitors as such. I mean, the closest one I suppose you could possibly say is Revolut, but then they don't really offer as much as you guys.
No, they got a different business model. I do use Revolut. I do like it. Again, I think they could run into regulatory issues. They're trying to get a banking license. I don't know how that's going to turn out. I don't think you need a banking license anymore for these sort of things. You can do them under different licenses or with partners. But Revolut, you know, they raised a lot of money and they went for customer acquisition. And something I was going to say earlier, which I forgot, was it's all very well building a business and having millions of customers, which I clearly want. and Revolut has. But those customers are, as I said, secondary or tertiary bank account for those customers, a Revolut account for them. That's not attractive for another player to come in and say, well, we're going to buy your customer base. And a lot of these people seem to give some sort of pitch that they're building this business because they're going to build a customer base and they're going to sell it back to Barclays. Well, the majority of those customers are probably Barclays customers anyway. So I'm just not sure what the end game is for some of these guys that have spent all this money and the losses are tens and tens and twenties and millions. I just don't get it. So I think the jury must be out on these a lot of these companies.
And how do you then, as Mode, how do you be different from that then? How do you go against that grain, if you like?
Well, I think profitability is one of our key sort of focus points. You know, we believe we can be profitable within 3 years from say the beginning of this year. We have a business model that says we can in terms of the products and the services we will deploy. And we're not out for a land grab. So that's probably the difference. The marketing spend for Mode is the tens of thousands so far. It's all been word of mouth. We are going to step that up very soon. And you know, a lot of people are asking when that's going to happen. It's going to happen soon. But we're not throwing millions and millions and millions of marketing dollars at this. We have a very specific business plan to get us to profitability. And we're not going to diverge away from that. We're not going to divert away from that. I think we've got a good opportunity to do what we say we're going to do, but it comes with maybe a less ambitious size of business in terms of customer base, like Revolut and Mondra. It's just a different approach.
But what do you want your customers to use Mode for then? I mean, at the moment, it's you can buy Bitcoin with it and you can hold pound sterling, you say. What is it you would like to see your customers using Mode for?
Well, I think at the end, Mark, we just want it to be their number one finance app. So they can manage their cash, they can pay their salary in there, they can pay for things just generally in the shop, whatever it is. Have the ability to buy and sell Bitcoin very easily, and we will add to that. We will probably add Ethereum at some point. I don't at this point ever see us going into tens or hundreds of different coins. I think we just stick to the big stuff, and people like that, by the way. People like that we have a one coin focus, which is Bitcoin. So we want them to use it as their banking application for everything. We don't intend to be a bank. We don't need to be, but it will act like a bank account like Revolut does. So to use all their sort of needs, whether it might be buying insurance, investing, saving, data management, could be anything. And then on the other side of things, being able to use it to go to merchants and buy and sell things. But more importantly, and in addition to that, at some point in the future, we will add a novel credit system so that you will be able to buy using our payment system, using credit that we will supply at point of sale. And I think the most interesting things are, small amounts of money for short periods of time. And maybe we're looking at things like, can we look at the credit scoring system in the UK and say, the credit scoring system in the UK is very archaic. It looks backwards only. Why couldn't we look forwards and say, well, Mark is likely to sell part of his property portfolio or get a better job and give them a better rate at the point of sale on interest based on data that they give to us or as sort of a data passport. So we're looking at all these sort of things. I think the ultimate plan, which isn't there today because we're at the beginning of this long road, and open banking's only been around 5 minutes, hence why we got first mover advantage, is at the end of the day for people to look at this like an Alipay app, where if you're a Chinese national in China, your financial services needs are all in Alipay. That's the end of it. And that's what we would like people to do in the UK and then beyond. So have everyone looking at this as a one-stop shop to do everything you need, not just banking, not just buying and selling things, but everything you need, from buying and selling Bitcoin or even borrowing against Bitcoin to buying a pair of shoes, getting credit and getting a better rate than your friend because you got a better job.
I must admit, I actually seen a news report from Miami that the local government were talking about paying their employees 50% cryptocurrency for their salary.
Yeah.
They were floating that idea. So, I mean, I see that's the way the world's going. Probably, I don't know, 10 years mainstream, probably most people will be getting paid in cryptocurrency. So yeah. you're going to need a mode style account anyway, probably just to get a job now. That'll be the first thing to ask.
I mean, I take anything I get remunerated from mode, I take in Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. I've now offered it to all the employees. We're putting in place a structure where they will be able to elect to take a small amount of their salary in Bitcoin if they want. And we're looking at Bitcoin incentive for the public company rather than having a old-fashioned option on a share. Can we do something with Bitcoin? So we're very much looking at the innovative side of utilizing Bitcoin, and probably just Bitcoin because it's the main one, but using that to remunerate people, pay people, use as collateral, whatever it might be.
Yeah, that's certainly a breath of fresh air. I've never heard anyone talking about that before in business. So yeah, you seem to be one step ahead of the pack anyway, or certainly going a different way from the pack, which is sometimes the best way to go. But all right, well, I think we've already been talking. That's nearly 50 minutes. Yeah, time flies, so it does. Mark, have you got anything to add before
Yeah, I do have something to add. It has flown by. It's fascinating, but I do have something to add, and it was more on just taking a, because it's the Market Musings podcast, and people might be looking to buy shares or invest in mode. What is the business model to generate income then? I mean, is it from transactions that customers do personally? You mentioned the payment system, you know, the merchants that you can interface with merchants directly, and people who want to buy from the merchants. I guess there's a plan to onboard merchants as well. And I don't know, you're almost trying to take on MasterCard and Visa. It's more a question of, where's the sort of revenue generating? Where's the investment case, I should say?
Yeah. So I do tell people that I'm trying to take on MasterCard and Visa, and they usually put the phone down or leave the room.
Okay.
But I say it with a bit of a joke to it, but we are trying to do something that would be bypassing those credit card companies. Mm. And it's much more secure, it's safer, it's quicker, and it's less cost to the merchant or the customer. So it's on that basis, it's all good. It does things cheaper, safer, and more secure for all users over and above credit cards. So that's the first point. We earn money from trading fees regarding buying and selling crypto. We will, and we do receive fees from payment volume that goes through our system. So Alipay, WeChat Pay, and then the new business that we deploy will earn on transactions. We will also be, as I said, looking at credit very soon, which is obviously lending, which will give us an interesting revenue model in terms of a couple of different things. One is point of sale lending. Also, the possibility of crypto-backed lending, which is a bit immature at the moment in the UK, and they're looking at ways to get that into the regulation, and we are having discussions about that. And we have advertising sort of campaigns for merchants that we work with where we earn from that too. So there's four or five clear revenue streams, along with a number of other things that are coming on, which we haven't quite defined yet. But we believe the business, it is a volume business, but the business can be profitable within 3 years. If we compare ourselves to peers, other public, there's no real other public company like us in the UK and actually anywhere. We are one of, if not the only public company in the UK that has a consumer crypto Bitcoin offering at its core. That is a very, very sort of key differentiator from anybody else. But if you look at our peers and you look at the market value, so we're roughly £50 million as a market cap. Revolut is probably £12 billion now. Monzo one, Starling maybe two, Wirex maybe $1 billion. You can list a load of companies. There's clearly an arbitrage between what we are doing as a public company, which people haven't necessarily understood fully yet because we haven't been able to get out and tell the story enough.
Mm-hmm.
To these other companies, there must be an arbitrage. They're probably worth too much, but we might be worth too little.
Mm-hmm.
I think the investment case is one of uniqueness, a Bitcoin offering at our core, a payment system that's never been delivered before. We've got a great team, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
We hired less than a year ago, I hired the CEO of Alipay Europe. So we've got a woman who has built the European business for Alipay and onboarded something like 300,000 merchants. She works for us, which is a major coup for us.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a great group of people. So there's a number of differentiators and uniqueness, and the investment case is pretty clear. We're doing something new. We're doing it well. We're doing it in a public environment, and the business model is focused on profitability, not as soon as possible, but within a short space of time, 3 years, rather than let's spend as much money as we can and see where we end up.
Mm. Okay, great. Well, yeah, that's fantastic. That's it for me then, Jonathan. Thank you very much for your time there. And Kenny, I guess, do you have any final thoughts? Or?
No, I mean, we could spend all day talking about banks and crypto. And I mean, there's so many topics you can get into.
But, I think we should have Jonathan on again.
Yeah. I think we should.
Next time, maybe we can talk about mining.
Yeah, we can. Sure.
In a few years. Do you guys obviously do a lot of mining companies, do you?
Yeah, it tends to be a sort of bread and butter, but it's nice to get a bit of sort of finance and tech in the mix as well. So we've done a few podcasts with Coincilium, which is in the sort of crypto blockchain builder space as well. So
yeah,
it's good to learn all about what's going on in the world.
So if you had a choice, Kenny or Mark, would you buy gold or would you buy Bitcoin?
Well, Kenny, I know what Kenny will say, and it's not either of those two. But I'm going to say at this point, I would buy Bitcoin over gold.
Good, we've got another supporter.
Yeah, I'd probably buy crypto over gold, but I'm a silver bug.
Yeah,
so I like to physically hold it, and silver's a lot cheaper than gold, and the ratio between gold and silver needs a bit of correction, so it does. So I'm trying to collect 1,000 ounces, so I'm up to about 750 ounces at the moment, so I'm nearly there. But to answer your question, yeah, crypto, whether Bitcoin, I don't know. There's definitely opportunities out there, so there is.
Oh yeah, so, for sure. Yeah. No, yeah. I ventured into my first crypto, Jonathan, just before December. It's when I first bought my first crypto. And
yeah, never too late. It's never too late.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. So
we invested 10% of our cash reserves in October into Bitcoin. So
okay.
we still hold those. So we've done phenomenally well.
Definitely.
I think we paid an average of 10,000-11,000. It's 58,000 today. So
yeah.
So you do have like a treasury almost. You know, some of these companies have like a crypto treasury. So does Mode have a crypto treasury as such as part of their core holding?
We were the first public company in the UK to announce that we had put part of our treasury into Bitcoin.
And we have just been adding to that recently. So we hold certainly north of several million pounds in Bitcoin.
All right. Excellent. That's refreshing as well. No, fantastic. But no, it's been great having you on, Jonathan. And like I say, we'll need to get you back on because, you know, there's just so much to talk about. I mean, I'm just getting into NFTs. I don't know if that's something that you've dabbled in yet. Non-fungible tokens.
No, but one of the guys at work for me is an expert, and maybe we'll get him on with me next time because he'll really lose you in the technology.
It'll be great.
Yeah, definitely, because that's a huge. I was going to swear there. I better know. It's a huge snowball down the hill towards us. So as NFTs, that's coming mainstream, whether we like it or not. That's my prediction, and you can hold me to that. So you can. I think we'll be using NFTs for absolute everything going forward to secure assets and identities and etc. So there we go. On that note, before you get me started in the NFTs, I think we'll just call it there. And appreciate your time on a Friday afternoon, Jonathan.
Thanks very much.
Yep, it's been great. It's fantastic.
Thank you, Jonathan. Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Thanks then. Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings with Fairbairn and Russell. Tune in next time.